It feels good right now. It is an honor for me to be moderating this event, and more importantly, to be associated with tonight such righteous folk. You guys are incredible. This conversation isn't just going to be happening up here. It's going to be happening all over this room. I see friends. I see family. I see Oakland. And most importantly, I see community. So it's important to me that we welcome into this space, and we make this space welcome, and we welcome each other's presence with warmth and with love. So as serious as things can get tonight, let's be sure to smile a little bit. Let's smile at each other. As my mom says, smile loud, smile proud. It's one of the most beautiful things about us and about this community, because tonight we're going to be stepping in to conversation about us. Okay, we're going to be talking about where we've been, where we going, and how we going to get there amongst family, amongst friends, and amongst Oakland. So it is critically important that, you know, we bring up some tough questions, and we're going to have some honest dialogue as well. But hopefully we learn something along the way, not only about ourselves, but about each other, because that's critically important. So I just really want to just thank each and every one of you, because as my man said out of Brooklyn at one point, you could have been anywhere in the world, but you're here with me, with us tonight, and we appreciate the hell out of that. It is my hope tonight, finally, I just want to end with, it's my hope tonight that tonight you guys are challenged, you are inspired, but most importantly, you feel nourished, and you step out of here even more hopeful and even more excited and committed to all the things that need to happen. And if you know me, you know that I like to have a good time while doing it. I can talk about some serious stuff, but I like to party and I like to have a good time as well. So we're going to laugh as well tonight. So with that being said, I want to start bringing some folks up. And first and foremost, this man is incredible, because I done seen him live and he's able to do things with his body, with speech. Okay, through spoken word, he is a teacher, he is a creator. I'm just stunned by his level of creativity and all that he's done for the work. I'm talking about Bamuti, ladies and gentlemen. Please bring him up. Bamuti, there you are. This man, this next man needs little to no introduction. I just call him guilty. Guilty as charged. He's guilty for introducing us to Fela, for bringing Afrobeat here into the States. He's guilty for me losing weight every time he DJs, and I just got to come up out of my shirt and all kind of different things. But he's also a teacher. He's also a revolutionary in many ways. He's honest. He's real. He's creative. DJ Rich Medina, ladies and gentlemen. Rich Medina. And he's tall. Last but definitely not least, she was up here earlier, and you heard it, you felt it. I do every time I see her. She is real. Her voice has been described as honey dipped. Everybody. Soulful, grace, honest. She's town bound. If you don't know what that means, she's Oakland. North, south, east, west, Oakland, holding it down. She represents, she's also super involved. Jennifer Johns, ladies and gentlemen. Jennifer Johns. And she gets a special chair as well. Oh, yes, is this your one right here? Absolutely, queen. She got the special chair. So I guess I just want to open up, you know, with Oakland, and I want to talk a little bit about Oakland. Funny, I came from a trip about 2 weeks ago, and I told my boy, I said, no matter who we meet, we from Oakland, California, not San Francisco, we're from Oakland, California. No disrespect, but we from Oakland. So we made that pact, and I want to talk about Oakland, because there's a pride here. You could taste it. It's very real. Oakland's proud. Oaklanders are proud. And Jennifer Johns, I want to open, with you and talk about, what does Oakland mean to you, and why is Oakland so damn important?
Oakland is like my heart, you know? I think that when I go and travel and experience other things, I kind of see it through the lens of being from this place that when I was growing up, it was 330,000 people. It was 73% black, you know? It was ground zero for Black Panthers. It was also ground zero for the crack epidemic. And operating with the understanding that that was used as chemical warfare. You know, when you're functioning in the world and you're like, I see how the beauty and the pain, a different kind of way. So Oakland is special because it's the water, it's the mountains. You know, I was in Brooklyn for a while and I was like, you know, I love being in Brooklyn. However, you're in one place and it's all Black people in one place and it's like all white people in one place. In Oakland, it tends to just be mixed. You're just townish, you know? I appreciate that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wanted to ask Mr. Rich Medina, we oftentimes find you here in the Bay Area quite often. What does the Bay Area in Oakland, in your opinion, mean to you and also mean to the movement?
How's everybody doing? You all right? I mean, for me, Oakland is a place that, chiming off of what Jennifer stated, when it comes to the Black Power movement, when it comes to people speaking up about the system being against their fundamental human rights, when you speak about the Black migration from the South, where a lot of our ancestors ended up, you know, on a historical level and on a personal level, for me, I'm very interested in that history. Musically, for whatever reason, from the first time I came out to the Bay Area to play records, before I got off the plane back home, my email box was blown up, phone was blown up. I don't even know if we had text messaging back then. But, you know, there was a call and response for whatever reason when I came out here to play for the first time, and people sent some smoke signals back in my direction. And as an artist, I'm prone to cast my line where the fish are biting. And it's a lot of fish in the water in Oakland for me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Bamuti, I wanted to ask you, you've traveled all over the world. My question to you about Oakland is, what keeps you coming back?
Can I reframe the question?
Yes, you can.
Because I'm from New York, but I grow my family in Oakland. Mm. And so many of us, for financial reasons, for in anticipation of a particular professional trajectory, leave the town or leave the Bay Area, and so many of us come back. Coming from New York, kind of growing up inside of, you know, this country's major marketplace, I found that being here alleviates one of the pressure to create object or to create product inside of the marketplace itself. And there are many things that I love about Oakland, but I think what I love most is that it's a generative place. You know, we both Rich and Jen mentioned the water. And that's what I say to people. There's something in the water
right
here. Not just something in the water, but something to the fact that water is all around us. There is a placidity to this place.
Absolutely.
Calm over the turbulence in this place that I think makes it ideal for creation, that makes it ideal for generation. And that generation might be ideological, it might be uniform or practical, but there is a spirit of nurturing, I think, that is the undercurrent of the city, is the undercurrent frequency,
absolutely,
I'd say, of the city. And so it's not so much about coming back, it's about staying.
Right on, right on. And about staying and coming back, and I heard some of the figures that Jen was talking about, but I can't help but relate back to the news that a lot of us had gotten this morning, and that I, you know, we've been dealing with and that we've been seeing. The census data has come out, and it's very real that communities and urban areas are looking very different and will continue to look very different. How do we have that conversation about the inclusive nature of our cities in the soul of the city, named a campaign that we have at the Ella Baker Center. But is that something that we should be paying attention to, specifically whenever we're talking about the culture and the movements and all that you had just mentioned, Bamuti? Is that something you think that is an issue and that we should be considering as well?
I think that there's cultural life and there's life. We were talking a little bit earlier, and when we were growing up, the projection was in the year 2050, you know, you talk about census, you know, in the year 2050, the United States of America will be a majority minority country. And I think that, you know, that just always seems so far away to me. But Sister Shara asked, you know, if there was anybody under 21 in the room, there's one person under 21 in the room, which means that in the span of our aggregate lifetime, this country will be majority minority. So, you know, there are shifts in urban areas for sure, but along with, you know, this kind of shift in population and this transition that the country is experiencing in less than 30 years, we also globally are going to outstrip our current food production. In other words, there are going to be 9 billion people on the planet in the year 2042, right? So we're going to have to double our food production in order to feed everybody in less than a 30-year span. So when I talk about the relationship between cultural life and life and the soul of the city, it's way deeper than kind of the cultural vitality and the cultural wherewithal of the city. There are environmental issues that correlate to the cultural vitality or the cultural sustainability that also impact that metric or, you know, this rubric that you're talking about in terms of the proportion of folks of color in the city. Because if we continue to move in this way, if we continue to push folks of color to the outskirts, you know, of these cities, if we continue to reconfigure the urban center away from food and away from one another, if we continue to depopulate the common consciousness, we're going to be in a world of trouble. You know what I mean? Just because there's this distance between us and away from resources that is going to impact our wherewithal over the course of the next generation and a half. So yeah, there's the fight for cultural life, but it's a deeper fight than cultural life. It's a fight for life.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Do you have something you want to? I mean, we're dealing with what folks are calling food deserts and things like that. We're already there, you know?
Absolutely. I kept hearing about culture and Rich Medina. I wanted to ask you, because I know, you know, you've worked with Gil Scott, and I'm looking right now at a quote that he said that had me just tripping. When he was talking about the relationship between music and political movement, he said, music can actually be the most important tool that we have as people, as a tool of acknowledgement of those who have sacrificed, and to pass on oral history and culture if we let it be. It could be game if we let it be. It could be science if we let it be. But see, we take our presence right now too seriously. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like the brother was a prophet. Yeah. It's like the rest of us. I mean, you know, it goes without saying that there was a time period in the United States where for black folks, all of the fighting and bleeding and slaving and everything that has come with our existence here was based on civil rights, which is fundamentally the right to vote, the right to walk in the same door as white folks, and the right to use the same toilet. Like, that's kind of the tenets that our predecessors were looking for. And once we got it, a lot of us forgot all about that. A lot of our parents forgot about that, at least in terms of the continued indoctrination of that perspective into our generation. So I think that once we got what we were looking for, we were happy we got it, and we moved on to getting other things that in our minds signified making it or not. And because we hadn't had a history of being prepared to deal with sums of money, saving sums of money, paying things forward into your community. I mean, you look at the Black community nationwide, the dollar does not circulate. The dollar exits. But when you go into the Hispanic community, it circulates 8 or 9 times before it moves out. You go in the Jewish community, it circulates 25, 35 times before it moves out. You go into any other cultural dynamic in the United States, the infrastructure within that cultural breakdown, there's a particular piece of that doctrine that's based off the fortification of your own, whatever your own may be. So all these elements that were denied Black folks in the United States for so long, in one sense you could say, oh, woe is me, we didn't have it for so long, we don't know how to do it, but it's 2011 and now we're looking back at it and saying, damn, you know, I'm 30 some odd years old and civil rights movement was over before I was born. I went to college. I've been walking in the same door as white boys my whole life. And I ain't done a damn thing to speak to this movement that me and my friends are very conveniently attached to when it serves our individual agenda. So I think that what Gil Scott-Heron was saying is that Black folks at a certain point in time in the United States began to take the present as the only present they're gonna get. Not only that, but a great deal of our ancestors and predecessors also had a firm belief in the everlasting on. And I think some of my elders in the room know what that means. And if you don't, the belief in the everlasting on means that there is a God out there that is going to take you to a better place than what you have now. So continue to toil, continue to struggle, and continue to praise him at least one day a week. And when you're gone, you're going to be all right.
Absolutely.
And now we're paying for it.
Yes, yes. But we're not. Yes, absolutely. Jennifer, we're not that far removed, though. And I have this conversation sometimes with my dad. My family's Ethiopian, and they mention things from centuries under this emperor and this king and whatnot. But when you think about like the civil rights movement, as Rich brought up, you know, we're talking about like 40 some years ago. When you talk about slavery, mm-hmm. you know, it's everything's relatively
recent.
Mm-hmm. So why are we moving in the direction that we're moving when things are relatively recent to all movements? I mean, things are as recent as last week.
Well, you know, what's the brother from Poor Righteous Teachers? Did you guys see that video? And he was talking about, and when the Rodney King riots happened, folks was in the streets wilding, right? Folks was like, this shit right here, not so much, right? But at that time, you could only own 6 radio stations, 6 newspapers, and 6 television stations at a time. In 98, when Colin Powell's son rolled in and was like, we gonna shake up this monopoly situation. Michael Powell, there we go. When Michael Powell rolled in 98 and was like, you know what? I think that if you got money, you should just be able to own stuff. Things changed. And so I think that, you know, we can look at a few segments of time. Yeah, it was recent, but I think we were having that conversation in a different kind of progression in the 90s than we are now. Certainly because the things that are informing our consciousness, the things that we hear, the mantras that we create for ourselves are not empowering. You know what I mean? Viacom and Clear Channel runs your life. You know, and so if you're not tuned into the KPFAs or the youth radios or the, you know, KQED or whatever that experience is where you are, you don't know.
Absolutely. Bamuti, this reminds me of a quote that you once said when you was talking about the relationship to a culture, a way of doing and being, but then you expand on being relegated to the machine. And you were talking about
I said that.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
Damn.
Well, just to give you some context. Yeah, you were breaking it up. Look, I'll tell you what you said. You were talking about the relationship to culture and where we were at in culture and how you identified with the 60s and the 70s in a very close way and how currently we're relegated to a machine. And when I hear her talk about, you know, Viacom and the way that things are and just our access to information, so to speak, I think of you and I think about the work that you do as well. So I'm wondering if you could expand on that.
Wow. I roll with this choreographer, Hunsi, goddess named Adia Whitaker. She talks about, neo-folklore. She talks about future folklore. And as she talks about diasporic people of the hip-hop generation creating folklore. And you know, she started using this vocabulary around me, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years ago. Sounded really good. I just started saying it too. Neo-folklore, future folklore, it sounds great. Then the idea sunk in a little bit as I started to become a little bit more conscious of the falling away of my own body, the gradual yellowing and graying and aging of my own body, and recognizing that folklore is of the body. And that hip-hop culture, what makes hip-hop culture so dynamic, I think, is that it's the last mass cultural movement that doesn't need eeps, ops, orcs, or ah-ahs, you know what I mean? It doesn't need, like, it's hip-hop ultimately is not of the machine, though it is generated and profligated by machines of all sorts. It is a culture, unlike the social network that we all live in, that is predicated upon proximity, closeness, and intimacy. Sounds that we make from our mouths, ciphers that we call into being. And so, you know, the move or the tension maybe between the machine and the body is going to be something that we all deal with. Speaking of the machine, you know, it's just going to be something that is a tension that we're just all going to explore, I think, for generations to come. But I invite students, certainly, and colleagues to remember the body, to generate to use the body as folkloric instrument, specifically to make something other, or more, or meta, or macro. And I think part of the reason why I, to Jen's point, part of the distance I think that we have from physical anarchy is that we are very, very conveniently located inside of safe boxes where we can literally yell from our keyboards at a safe distance, you know? So I invite us all to remember the body as radical revolutionary instrument to make new folklore of the body.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Rich Medina, what is your current relationship to hip hop in 2011?
I'm a lifelong B-boy. I'm a card-carrying member of Rocksteady.
You saw that, right?
Card-carrying member of Zulu Nation. Hip-hop is my life. It's not. I don't have to think about it. It's not a proposition. It's not a notion. I exist through it every day, the way I wear my hat, the way I choose to tie or not tie my sneakers, the language I use when I'm in certain areas. It's who I am.
Absolutely.
It's that simple.
And you said, and your vinyl collection, if you guys know, is many. And you said vinyl is the origin of my personal love for music. Why is that?
Because growing up as a 70s kid on the Upper East Coast of the United States, I was blessed with the luck to have been born into a time in the hip-hop culture that everyone romanticizes. I was there. It's not romantic to me at all. So at that time, there were no MP3s. There were no AIFF files. There was no text messages. There were no rapping marshmallows on television. White women were horrified of the Bronx. I say that gently to paint a picture, and the picture that I'm painting is the fact that hip-hop culture was designed by Afrika Bambaataa to stop gang movement. Rather than stab you or shoot you or jump up in your territory and take your stuff, I'ma outdance you, I'ma outpaint you, I'ma outenjoy you, I'ma outspeak you. And we're both gonna live to talk about it the next day. And if I beat you today, we're gonna do it again tomorrow because I wanna beat you worse. And I know you want some of this again. But you don't know that you really don't. Because I only gave you a couple of little clips. I got a whole leg full of clips over here I'm gonna give you. So that whole tenet of friendly, positive, forward-thinking competition through creativity is something that I utilize for feeding my family, for paying my mortgage, and for keeping my spirit as high as it can possibly be to this day. I've been in the machine, I've been in the system, I played semi-pro basketball, I've had two Fortune 500 jobs, I went to an Ivy League institution, and all of it was an interruption to my lifestyle.
There it is, there it is. And I think right there, I wanna expand, and I wanna let the whole group answer this question because each of you have had some experience with the industry at some point, currently, whenever. And for some, every time I'm in the barbershop, everybody in the barbershop knows the industry and can tell you who runs the industry, what's behind the industry. But I wanted to know what is the thing that we need to know about the industry, so to speak. In our understanding of the industry.
Which industry?
Well, I'm talking specifically about the music industry.
It's a top-heavy organization that fell down a couple years ago.
Word.
It's like a barrel on sticks. Fill up the barrel with water, the sticks will break. The barrel will fall, water will spill. Those of you who have plastic cauldrons, calabashes, things like that, you might catch some water. If not, you better find your way to a new lake, because without the water, you ain't gonna make it. That's literal, figurative, pertaining to this point, pertaining to black, white, green, orange, it really doesn't matter. The industry fundamentally is over. And the world is awash with the work of the prosumer. And if you're not familiar with what the term prosumer means, as a working class DJ dealing with the music industry on an everyday basis, there's no firewall to entry in my business. You wanna be police, you go to the academy. You wanna go to college, you take the SAT. You wanna be in the military, you go to boot camp. You wanna be a DJ, you go to the Apple store, you go to Guitar Center, you jump on iTunes. The ill part of it is, at the end of the day, practice and preparation is what is going to allow you to maintain a job. So as a person who has survived in the industry for a very long time, I don't have any personal negative feelings about celebrity DJs or new school DJs. I was that person at a time. The issue is when you come into a place where there is par and you're not meeting par, and because the person who is paying you has no concern for par, you degrade the work that myself and all the party people and all the other DJs and music makers and club owners and bartenders and barbacks have done all these years. So the industry in and of itself fundamentally is a corpse. It's just doesn't need any formaldehyde. It's not gonna rot. It's just gonna lay in your face and look kind of alive-ish.
On the other hand, though, I think it's really an exciting time. Like, they're all dead, everyone's dying. No, on the other hand, I think it's a really exciting time for music. because if you have some chops, if you have some gumption inside of you, you got a little bit of game, you just a little townish enough, you can really do something amazing. And you can own it all, you know what I mean? So while major labels are doing these 360 deals, if you don't know what that is, that's they own a piece of your merchandising, a piece of your performance, and your music, it's the whole
360,
right? But you can 360 yourself, you know? And my favorite, one of my favorite Jay-Z quotes is, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. You know, so if you got some game, it's a really awesome time to be in the industry, or non-industry thing.
You just reminded me of a quote of yours that you said, before anything else, you are music.
Word.
Can you explain that real quick?
I'm a vessel in the way that God has chosen to express through me, first and foremost, is through sound. So I am music.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wanted to... bring in Nina Simone into this conversation.
Ashe.
Yeah, Nina, one time, Nina. Mm-hmm. I recently saw an amazing interview. Some of you guys probably have seen this. It was, she was on BBC, and she was talking with a older white gentleman. And the question was, Nina Simone, when you get on stage, what's in your mind? Like, are you just singing? And Nina, if you guys ever seen Nina, just very proud, says, to move the audience, to make them conscious of what's been done of my people across the world. And then the interviewer is perplexed. He says, well, then you must sing from a place of anger, Nina. And Nina cuts him off and says, no, I sing from a place of intelligence, letting them know that I know who they are. Hey. Now that, even talking about it, gives me chills. But I wanted to talk to the team about responsibility and what Nina was saying in that, and she has had many quotes about the industry as well. So Bamute, I wanted to start with you about what Nina said in that piece.
I go on stage to the question was, what is going through your mind, yes, or what's on your mind. And I go on stage to lose my mind. Word. I don't know if anybody else does. But that's my intent. And the journey to disappearance, you know, it's a trip. Like I use my body to leave it, you know? And that journey, if everything is tuned right, is a collective one where there's safe space for collective growth, transition, and transformation. So there is design in that, in the same way that Nina's not just singing, or Coltrane isn't just playing notes, or Kobe isn't just randomly balling, or there's a higher reptilian intelligence, you know, a low end that's at work. The base of the spine, the low end, is almost always at work, I think, in what we do. And it is both low and a higher form of intelligence, because it doesn't correspond, I think, to the part of our brains that deconstructs or distills or categorizes. It corresponds to the part of all of us that is antenna, mm-hmm, that is lightning rod for something higher. And conventionally, we don't call that realm of perception intelligence. Which is okay, because it's actually something other. It's extraterrestrial in a lot of ways. And so, you know, the question is, are you using your instrument to channel? And if you are, then we know that, waves go both ways. if you're using your instrument to channel, then in fact, you're doing more than communicating. You're listening, and as Jen says, you become vessel. I don't know if that has anything to do with SATs or, you know, street smarts or anything. I just know that it's wholly other. It's bigger than intelligence. It's love.
Yes. Talking about that responsibility, Rich Medina, you were asked in an interview, what can one expect from one of your shows? And you said, you can expect to laugh, sing, dance, and hopefully with more freedom than you felt before. Now, I personally sense a great deal of responsibility in the same frame that Nina Simone was speaking. It's not just about DJing with you. It's about so much more, isn't it?
I mean, I think any of us who get in a public forum and display a skill set or a talent or a mindset to a group of people, at least in my mind as a Black American, you know, both sets of my grandparents took the Underground Railroad, so I'd most definitely have a very serious responsibility to what they went through. You know, every time my phone dies and I'm going bananas, crazy, angry over a contraption, or my car won't start, or a window sash won't close, and I'm going crazy, and I'm like, damn, you know. You know, my grandparents and their friends is way tougher than me and my friends. You know, they had some whole other concerns. So it kind of, for me, I come from a family of men of the cloth. I chose not to go that route directly, but the club is a church for me. And I've only come to feel that way about it in the last few years, and it probably has to do with fatherhood and maturity that comes with that. But, you know, I definitely feel as though that there is a responsibility to defeat some of the notions that are out there in the world for what young Black American men are about. Not all of us are about misogyny. Not all of us wear our pants down behind our kneecaps. Not all of us sell drugs. Not all of us speak broken English. I wouldn't even say Ebonics. And to be clear, there's nothing wrong with broken English. But the point that I'm making is that we are a rainbow of dynamics that, in my job capacity, I'm blessed with the opportunity to deal with clusters of people. And, you know, in a utopian world, if there's a room with 300 people in it and you get to touch every single person, that's utopia. But I think utopia is something that happens when you pass. So when you have the opportunity to move 5 people out of those 300, and those 5 people go home and say, yo, I never heard so-and-so behind so-and-so behind so-and-so. It didn't make me, oh, man, I'm thinking of, yo, man, you got to come with me next time. Then you got a room with 300 people, and those 5 people that were feeling it the last time, they brought maybe 2 or 3 people apiece. And then it becomes the Vidal Sassoon commercial, you know, and so on and so on and so on. So I definitely feel a severe responsibility to walk the line and to dance outside of the top 100, to dance outside of the top 40, to dance outside of the musical perspectives that are force-fed down our throats. I mean, think about it like this. This is clearly a room of high consciousness. Everybody in here knows who Trick Daddy is. Not because you like Trick Daddy's music, because he is marketed down your throat. Imagine if all the artists that actually had 70% of their record based on forward-thinking content was shoved down your throat in the same way. You gotta wonder, would things be a little bit different? Being a young Black American man coming from the lineage that I come from, you would also think that some of that consciousness would have penetrated our generation to a particular degree as well, and it has not. So to walk that line, I think, is a serious responsibility for any of us that have the luxury of being in that position.
Absolutely. Che Guevara once said, let me say at the risk of seeming ridiculous that the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Johns, when you sing, I hear love.
I feel love.
Where does your love come from? And I just want to bring in for a second, one of the times that you moved me the most was probably a week after the killing of Oscar Grant, when you sang at City Hall. And I remember it was just, I mean, people was just on it. And you came in there, took off your shoes like you always do, and you sang from your heart like a revolutionary would love. Can you talk about that moment and just about your greater feelings of love through your work?
I think that, you know, we talked offline about the idea that a lot of activists are constantly telling folks that the sky is falling. We're like, oh, global warming, and there's 100 and however many homicides in Oakland, and the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling constantly, right? And I think that if you are a human with eyes, or if you have any sense of vibration at all, you're aware that there's a whole bunch of BS that's going on constantly, right? But we've reached past the space of this level of anger actually motivating people. People have become desensitized. And so we have to operate from a space of love. We don't have another option. I don't see another option. And so Bamuthi talks about using his body as a means to lose his mind. One of the things that's really exciting about tomorrow night is that I'm excited about God going crazy through me. You know what I mean? I'm gassed up about the idea that I get to be present for something that I'm not gonna be present for. You know what I mean? Like, you feel me? Like, and the idea is that we have everything that we need within us right now. Always have and always will. You know, and it's to the degree that we're willing to tap into that divine understanding that we transform things. You know, and so, you know, we're in this Aquarian space now, right? And the sky is falling. It's up to us to not just raise the roof, but break that motherfucker. You know what I mean? So that we can reimagine, you know, artists. I want to say that it was Nina that also said the role of the artist is to present the times for the people, right? And to help people reimagine. We need to sit down and go, what if? Fill in the blank, and stick around for each other to listen for what the what if might be. You know, there are no ridiculous ideas of possibilities now, you know? And when I sing, my goal is really just to show up so that spirit can do what spirit does. And that's my only responsibility. And I'm fucking up if I don't do that. When I think and I show up with my shoes on and I try to be a diva, it doesn't work, and I've tried. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Y'all see me? It doesn't work. But when I show up and I'm like, you know, then people leave with what he was talking about. You know, like, I feel like I got transformed and it wasn't my job. That's not what I did. That was what spirit did through me, you know? And I think we all have that responsibility. It's not just the active artist on the stage. We are all co-creating with spirit constantly, right? And so it's all of our responsibility to show up and paint and create and sing and vibrate with love.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Johns. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. One of those what ifs, ironically, 2 weeks ago, my mom showed me a letter that I wrote. It was a what if piece of homework in third grade, and I said, what if we had a black president? And she showed it to me like last week, and I was bugging out like, yo, this is many. Earlier this year, President Barack Obama, have y'all noticed, by the way, that some people just call him Barack? Earlier this year, President Barack Obama showed his birth certificate. And a lot of people, you said what now? In extremely comedic fashion,
best.
A lot of people did call it that and called it a strategic win as well, but there was a lot of folks in our communities that call it one of the most shameful days in this country's history. And I just wanted to get your all's thoughts on that, if you guys had an opinion. And does President Obama complicate things, or does he make things easier in your mind?
I thought the shit was funny. I thought it was funny
as hell. I thought the best part was when he was like, here is the video of my birth. And then did anybody see? Everybody saw that, right? Yeah, I think you gotta, there's some ignorant, bored humans on this planet. They're bored. They need to be inspired, y'all. We need to go outside and sing to them. They are bored. You know, and let them be bored then. You know, but you can only be responsible for what you got right now, and that's you. And so operate with love. Give them permission. When you shine your light, you give them permission to do the same. Be not concerned with the dumb asses that are out there asking for this man's birth certificate, and then be there to rejoice with the brother when he smashes for 18 minutes at the correspondence speech.
I feel like I'm playing double dutch with myself. I'm like, if I start talking, then I'm just gonna.
Come on, my movie.
All right, brothers, all right.
I will just say, this goes back to population control, immigration, the year 2040, and white supremacy. Yeah, because the conversation isn't about Barack Obama and his birth certificate. That's actually not the conversation. There are lots of bored people that just, you know, there are lots of bored people. There are also lots of racists. They're also tactical racists.
Word.
And there are also super wealthy, strategic racists. Yeah, Koch, Koch, Murdoch, whoever. So there's, you know, there are folks that are interested in making money, and the whole birth certificate thing makes money for them because there are commercials and we watch and newspapers get sold. And so there's a capitalist game that's being played, and I want to try to stay away from that and just acknowledge that there's a capitalist game that's being played with the identity of the President of the United States, wherein he is just an emblem for other. But there's a bigger game of which President Barack Obama is also an emblem or a pawn in our collective consciousness, a signpost. And it really takes the shape, I think, of the immigration debate in this country. We're not tripping on Europeans coming to the United States of America. Actually, we're not really tripping on anybody but Latinos coming to the United States of America, just truth be told. That's the thing, right? That's the thing. There is a concerned, resourced body of folks that do not want this country to get any browner, because we are losing resources at an alarming rate. The planet is. So when the seat of power is of color, like Barack Obama is just the face of imperialism. He's just a face. He's just a symbol of empire, of something else. The discussion really is not about Barack Obama or his birth certificate. The discussion is how easily distracted we all are and how caught up we get in emblems and symbols, because, you know, events like this, or, you know, the party tomorrow, that to me, that is my political party. You know what I mean? Like, tomorrow at the Gods Must Be Crazy, or this moment right here, this is a political party, because it is a group of folks willing to engage in deeper conversation about sustainability through spirituality and collective survival. Yeah? So I keep holding back because I think that ultimately it doesn't do us much good to have that debate about the symbol. I feel like there's a deeper conversation that needs to happen. And those conversations
aren't necessarily through spoken language. I think some of those conversations start in body language, which is why this man and purveyors of sonic waves are so important, because they call us together in a different kind of way. When Rich was talking about the genesis of hip hop being friendly competition through, you know, through peaceful means, like, all that again is vibration and frequency. The dancers gather around the sound, right? So the whole thing about who's being marketed, that's a deeper conversation, because what sounds are we gathered around? What vibration are we collectively gathered around? You know, when I drive my kid to school, I remember my kid was like 3 years old. I was driving my kid to preschool, and I wanted to listen to hip hop because I grew up in, you know, the 1970s and 1980s in New York, and I'm a child of hip hop, and so I turn on KMEL, and I turn on KMEL, and the Whisper song is on. Wait, do you see my? I'm like, yo, I'm taking my kid to preschool. It's 7:30 in the morning. Wait till you see my, at 7:30 in the morning? So rather than gather around these distracting campfires of birth certificates and Trumps and Bachmans and all that stuff, what I would like to see is more of us gathered around, I think, an elevated conversation around sound, resources, spirituality, and sustainability, because that is what's going to take us further, not who's president in 2012 or 13.
Thank you. Rich Medina, you once said Fela Kuti had brass balls. What were you getting at there?
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to request Mark's intelligence to sit in my head before. Fela Kuti has brass balls. Fela Kuti has brass balls because the things that Fela Kuti was saying in his music were purely community-based, and they were purely community-based in the hometown of black-on-black crime. The difference between black-on-black crime in the States and black-on-black crime in Nigeria is that the black-on-black crime in Nigeria is based on oil and based on a military police state and based on the deepest ramifications of colonialism of any country in the world. So James Brown saying, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud," in the United States was a hell of a set of balls too. But we weren't in a police state. And I don't say that to dismiss the degree to which we were under a form of police state. Allow me to be 1,000,000% clear. I'm not generalizing the American experience to be something smaller than what it was. But do it in Nigeria. It's a whole different power. And millions and millions and millions of folks coming out to rally. Police coming up in your house, harassing your mother and father, who are well-respected educators and politicians and people who have paid their dues within the structure of the country and helped the country in very many ways in the educational system and in the political system. And for them to come take your defecation out of your toilet and test it for marijuana, as if a musician smoking marijuana is causing the country to revolt, as if the things that the country is revolting against will deteriorate the quality of life for everyone who lives in the country. The oil reserves aren't going to go anywhere. The problem in that situation was a dissemination of power and a dissemination of wealth when those monies were divided up. You know, a lot of people say, well, the white man did slavery, and, you know, that's bad, but, you know, it was some tribal kings giving us away for rum and gunpowder as well. So you gotta really, you know, if you're gonna be in a court in front of a jury of your peers, the truth indeed shall come out. And I think that Fela brought a particular truth in his vocabulary on a basis so consistent and so abrasive to the powers that be that would connote metal in his drawers.
Well said. Jennifer Johns, who do you channel whenever you're when you're performing? Is there anybody in particular that you bring through or that you shine through?
No.
Okay.
No. I roll around with my granny on my jacket these days.
Why is that?
She was a gangster. She was a gangster. She was a bit of a thug. She she was a black woman who raised six kids, you know, and I feel like in East Oakland, being a black woman raising these six kids, it's pretty much a thug. And so I like to ask my grandma to show up with me these days. She passed a couple years ago, but besides that, I don't, her along with whatever ancestors want to show up that day, you know, spirit, really.
Absolutely. Bamuti, you brought up Harriet Tubman and Muhammad Ali as inspiration and as people you look to anytime you're scared, anytime you see folks in the audience. Why is it Muhammad Ali and Harriet Tubman?
Harriet Tubman kept going back. The fuck? She kept going back. She kept going back. You know, like, choose your word of emphasis here. She kept going back. So, boom, that's that. Yeah, I'm saying, yeah. So, and Muhammad Ali, right. And everybody know what I'm referring to? I realize I just said the same sentence five times in a row, but everybody understand what I'm referring to? Yeah, okay, cool. And then Muhammad Ali did something that I don't know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Muhammad Ali, at the peak of his career, you know, talk about using your body. This is the most, you know, finely tuned human machine in the world. This is the heavyweight champion of the world. And at the peak of his career, at the pinnacle of his physical prowess, was stripped of his ability to feed his family, doing the thing that he was better at than anybody else on earth. And at any moment could have been like, you know what, cool, I'll go. Muhammad Ali was drafted into the armed forces. They were going to send him to Vietnam, and he refused to go. And gave up everything and lost. You know, they're men and women that lose the best part of their lives in jail or in bad relationships. Right, we lose the best parts of our lives and the best parts of ourselves. Almost no one does that voluntarily. And no one is the best at the world at what they do and is confronted with the decision to either stand on, you know, your principles or, you know what I mean? And he chose to stand on his principles. And so for me, those are the two most courageous people. Those are the two most courageous acts that I've read, engaged with, encountered, or witnessed. The ability to keep going back and the ability to give up what you have to stand on principle.
Absolutely, absolutely. We were just talking about, you mentioned sustainability and creativity. It's no joke that programs are being cut with regards to the art. And there is, you know, a lot of disproportionate effects for a lot of our community, both economically and also musically and in the arts. Are we set for a creative crossroads in many ways, or What's the bridge that we can cross, especially with you all as amazing artists as you all are? How can we bring that communication together, that connection together, especially in this time when everybody's saying we're broke, we don't got enough money to pay for this or pay for that? We may be losing generations.
Clarity on the question. Okay. You're saying because there's no music in the schools, how are we to generate creativity through our next generation?
Because so many programs are being cut, and I think the valuing of after-school programs, whether it be sports or music or whatnot, mm-hmm. as artists as you guys are, what's the connection we can make? How can we sustain
those programs?
Yes, yes.
I think that because of our distance from the core decision making within the systems that make those decisions about whether or not those programs stay in place, there's a certain piece of helplessness. I think because it's 2011 going on 2012 and it's the information age, that dismisses that point at the same time. You know, it takes a lot more than romance and rhetoric to defeat a monster that's so wide sweeping. You know, we're not talking about this only happening in Oakland. If this was only happening in Oakland, California, it wouldn't be happening anymore. People would have, you know, our parents and our parents' friends and the people who our parents break bread with who have money and influence and power in that situation would have rallied against that. You know, everybody wants the one bad apple out, if you will. But because it's nationwide and because it's across a broad number of systems and pecking orders and clandestine brotherhoods and financial decision makers that, you know, there's business people making medical decisions now just the same. That's why you have HMOs. That's why you go to the doctor and you need Biaxin and he gives you penicillin because he knows you're going to be back in 2 weeks paying that copay. That guy used to make $500,000 a year before the invention of the HMO. Now he makes $108. And in his world, he's broke. But he ain't broke. It's context. So I think that there's do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do still exists. I think that people have instruments in their homes. I think that people have historical relations to people who are tied to music and tied to instruction and tied to the idea of caring for children. And I think that there needs to be a reinvention of the effort to address what community really is, because what community was in 1975 is not what community is now. The community, the same people, if we didn't have Facebook and Twitter and this and that, maybe we would all have a clandestine congregation. Maybe we would be using our communication tools to send coded data and to send kites across the yard to each other like prisoners do, because that's the only way they get their points across. And not all of those points that are being sent in those kites are negative. Some dudes are sending each other chess pieces. Some dudes are writing out charts of music and sending them back and forth to each other because it's like, yo, if I don't see these notes, dude next to me that have been popping off to me for the last week, I'm going in his mouth. Period. So there's all these different layers and dynamics to how information gets passed back and forth. And I think a vast majority of the time, a great deal of us who have the influence and the power to affect the point very often are detached from the point, because this is not the community age. This is the get mine age. And those of us who may have gone through certain struggles in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, now that that's over, they're like, ooh, shit. I'm tired of that shit. I'm about to go shopping. You know what I'm saying? I think that plays across the board. I think everybody's got a little bit of play in their responsibility. So I think that there's a particular tangent of all of us that have a deeper reach into those systems, a better understanding of how data is passed around in those systems and how stopgaps can be put in place to stop certain sweeping decisions that are fundamentally destroying the fabric of the country. Because, you know, every politician in office now, every high-ranking business person, every person who's in any form of power in the United States benefited from after-school programs, sports programs, music programs, sitting in music class, sitting in art class. They may not have become that, but it has indeed fed their perspective, just like math and science and other things has fed our perspective, and we feed that into what we do. I think that those things play in both directions, and I think that there's some folks on the other side of the fence that need to stop bullshitting us.
Bamuthi, was there anything else you wanted to add before we turn it over to the audience regarding this piece? Because I know you're an educator, you do some amazing work, so.
Yeah, I mean, I, in general, advocate for the repositioning of art inside of our civic machine and our civic engine. You know, we talked about this a little bit, but what I see is, you know, developers will put a Safeway on a block, right? And next to the Safeway, they'll put a Payless. Next to the Payless, they'll put a Starbucks. And next to the, right? And so the whole hype is you go to the Safeway, you go to the retailer to get, and around that dominant retailer, you can get all your other needs met. And so what I advocate for is a different way of creating these critical adjacencies by putting art at the center of the civic engine rather than a corporate space or a retail space. So what is it if at an arts festival you bring in the real estate developer, the food activist, the tennis player, the yoga instructor, the parkour course? This to me is what we call a creative ecosystem based on the diversity that's already happening in our communities, based on an idea that we share values, but we have different modalities. We share values, but we have different mechanics around executing those values. Some of us are lawyers, some of us are artists, some of us are gardeners. So while art isn't present in school, either the visual arts or music or cinema, while the art isn't present in school, I think that there's a way of developing small communities around artistic expression that unifies or gathers these different political interests or these different, you know, mechanics around creating the same thing. The way that I codify that is through a festival called Life is Living, which we do here in Oakland, we're gonna do in San Francisco, we've done in Houston, in Chicago, in Harlem, we're doing in Philadelphia, in Seattle, and we're doing a kickoff event in Minneapolis. And the point is to gather different folks around the value of life, to start with artistic institutions, academic institutions, philanthropic institutions, and environmental agencies, and invite those kind of four pillar organizations to bring in folks that share values but have different mechanics. And the outgrowth of this work is to create an artistic piece wherein art is at the center, but through this safe space for experiencing art, there's also the possibility to engage in the environmental conversation, to engage in holistic health, in total sports, et cetera, et cetera. So this is, you know, what I think isn't where we're headed, but it's a direction to head. While art is being taken out of schools, we can put art at the center of our civic life.
About that, Bamuthi.
At lifeisliving.org.
Okay, definitely.